Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can all go to once a week whenever it is movie night. Interesting people pop in to rent something, and we go through the films that they've loved across their life, and then when the store is quiet, I chat to my buddies about the films that we're watching on streaming platforms and out in cinemas. We're here to help you figure out what you can watch. All right, let's start the show. Let's open up the shop.
Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV?
Good morning.
Hey, Russell.
Hey, Russell.
How you guys doing?
All right, dude. How are you?
I'm lacking, man. We've got G-Force here.
Hello.
And we've got Cole.
Yo.
Colas McCoy. And we have ourselves a very exciting day at the video store today. This is an episode that has actually been many months in the making.
Mm.
2 days ago.
Yes.
We went to watch a special screening of Dune Part 2, the long-awaited second film by revered filmmaker Denis Villeneuve.
Something like that.
which is the adaptation of the very famous, much-loved science fiction novel Dune. And with it comes so much, because the book itself is so rich with this world building. I took great joy in reading the book for the first time last year. We are behind the counter with two individuals who have read it multiple times.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Graham, how many times?
I think 3 times.
Did you reread it now recently?
Yeah, I read it a little bit before the movie came out.
With this now part two?
Yeah.
Just like that?
Mm.
For me, it took the whole of last year.
I think it took me 4 or 5 days.
Wild! Jesus. Okay, that was obviously in between work contracts,
yeah.
Because you need full days to do that. Cole, you read it like 5 times.
Yeah.
Wild. And so for me, I was very excited to read it because there was a point where halfway through the book, I was now getting into the parts that I hadn't seen.
Right.
Because part one came out pre-pandemic, hey?
Yeah, it was around about pandemic. It was
pandemic.
2021.
2021 was when part one came out. And I watched that. Then now I read the book, and it was exciting to get past the point that I'd seen in the movie.
Yes.
And then I was onto my imagination. And then what was great was at 44 Stanley, such lovely people come in and visit the bioscope, and I see them all the time. And I bumped into Gerald, who is a lecturer of English Lit, a professor at WITS.
Yes.
And he taught me 2 years of English Lit, a few courses. And when we were talking about the podcast and the bioscope and what we're doing, it had come up the fact that he lectures a course on Dune.
Cool.
And so I told him about the podcast, and I said he'd be a perfect guest.
Yes.
So we've set this up where he joined us the other day at Mall of Africa to watch Dune Part 2, and he is on his way to visit us. And I want the three of us to have ourselves a good chat about the world of Dune.
Yes.
That sounds fantastic. It sounds like I'm going to get the critical thinking course I never got from university.
Yes. I was thinking we didn't have English Lit classes at AFTA.
At AFTA.
What a waste.
Yeah. So this is what was really amazing about WITS.
Yeah.
If someone had to say, why would you go to WITS over a more technical, focused film school?
Yeah.
WITS, you get the chance. You've got to fill up these BA, degrees.
Yes.
With other courses. And I just loved the idea of doing English Lit.
Yeah.
At that point in my life, I felt I could talk my way through like a record store. I could talk my way through a video store, but I couldn't. For me, I hadn't read that much. I wasn't that kid that had read Dune. I don't know when you started reading it for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, I was a bit more sporty, a bit more outdoors. But I needed those 2 years of English Lit to get a handle on, the classic books are the classic movies.
Yes.
or the classic albums. I was telling Gerald just before the screening started, I always thought my mom, for example, was so well-read because she was reading lots of books. But then you realize those books are like TV shows.
Yes.
You know, they're the new crime novel by James Patterson is like the new season of 24, yeah. You know?
Right.
It's smart. It's great. Mm-hmm. It's lovely. But it's like consuming TV.
Yes.
And then, of course, you've got books like Dune, which are these just epic, incredible books that become epic, incredible movies.
Mm.
And so I'm excited to have Gerald come and join us.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So I think on that point, what I'd love to do is I'd love to be the guy that just tries to contextualize it. I think let's start just from the beginning of what this thing is, and then we'll just slowly get through it more and more, and then there'll be a point where perhaps we'll have to tell you to stop.
Yes.
If you haven't read the book or if you haven't watched part two yet.
Yeah.
But I think what we're aiming for here is ultimately someone who just wants to listen to the whole chat because we're going to get into it.
Yep.
All right, boyos.
Yeah.
Let's do this.
Let's.
Okay. This is Gerald popping in to have a fat chat about Dune.
Good chin wag.
How's it?
Hello.
How are you?
I haven't seen you for years. You're one of my students, aren't you?
I was.
Yes. Your name was Russell.
That's right.
In fact, you lived in the same apartment block as me, Hanover Gate. Are you still there?
No, I'm not. I've since moved out. Are you still there?
No.
Okay. Nice to have you join us. How is everything?
Fine, thank you.
We all went on a lovely adventure 2 days ago.
Yeah, Wednesday.
Wednesday, to go watch Dune. And Gerald, you've been a part of a little plan we've been hatching for a while, which is in the exciting build-up to Dune Part 2, we wanted to do some special episode. You come to 44 Stanley every now and again, and so we were chatting quite a while ago. This was last year. When Dune Part 2 was scheduled to come out at the end of last year, it got delayed because of the writer's strikes. And it was revealed that you lecture a course on Dune.
Yes, I do, at English Honours in Vets. So, it's I wouldn't say it's a popular course. It's part of American literature. But any opportunity for me to smuggle in some sci-fi, and I take it with both hands.
Okay. Wait, so did you choose to put Dune in?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes, I did. I've been a fan since I first read this book an embarrassingly long time ago. I won't tell you how long exactly.
Yeah.
I think I was about 16 or 17 years old, and I'd been a keen sci-fi reader for some years already.
Yeah.
And I knew that this was an apogee of the genre, so I had to read it. And when I did, I was blown away.
Okay.
And I suppose what blew me away in the first instance, and I think what for me still sort of sums up why this text has been so successful, is that Frank Herbert turned a planet into a character.
Hmm.
Okay.
That's what I get from this book most powerfully. There are lots of other things involved, but for me, that's why it's been so successful as a sci-fi.
Okay. And so we thought it would be good to have you come in, and we've got Graham and we've got Cole here, and so the four of us, hopefully not too chaotically, are going to talk through Dune in general, because I think, as you've just alluded to, there's the question is why is this arguably the most famous science fiction novel of all time?
Hmm.
And so I think let's start with perhaps just a little bit of a context around it. It was written in the 60s, okay, by Frank Herbert. And as you said, it's all about this planet. So the planet itself is Arrakis. So we are thousands of years in the future, right?
Yeah, it's like 10,000 something.
10,000 years into the future, where there's no computers, right? They don't want computing.
Yeah, well, there's no AI.
There's no AI.
AI has been outlawed.
It's been outlawed, and as a result, they've discovered this particular spice, which is in the sand. It's in the sand of this desert planet, this barren desert planet. And this sand, I mean, this spice is able to give them some kind of cognitive power, right?
It's got like psychoactive capabilities.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And so that's how people in this galaxy use this spice to help navigate themselves, right? Yeah.
Right. Okay, not so only that, I have to jump in here.
The
famous phrase that's been used in any number of music tracks, in house music, trance, yeah, and so on, it's become part of popular culture, is this: the spice extends life, the spice expands consciousness, the spice is vital for space travel. So yeah, it's a longevity drug.
Yeah,
it's psychoactive in that it expands your consciousness and makes you clearly a more aware or psychinetic kind of being. And then finally, it's vital for space travel. But because there's no AI, no computers, the only way for them to navigate their way through the stars is via these spice-evolved navigators who are able to do this almost intuitively. And just to go back to Graham's excellent point about why AI has been banned, just assume that Terminator has already happened.
Yes.
There already has been a war against the machines.
Yeah.
So here we see a great strength of science fiction generally, but Frank Herbert in particular, which is that he thinks in these enormous millennial epochs.
Yes.
And that's right, part of the reason why this has been such a famous and successful book, is and with various series and movie spin-offs, is that it does encourage us to think long-term, really long-term.
Yeah, so he's already seen past the obvious, which is the robot war.
Right.
And so we've got these great houses, and whoever controls the manufacturing of the spice controls a lot and is super powerful, right? Yeah. But ironically, is having to live on a planet that's very inhospitable, covered in sand, just a desert planet. And our book starts with the main character, Paul, his family, his house. He's the son of the great Duke. And they've just been told they've got to now look after the spice. They've got to now take over the manufacturing.
Yes.
From the Harkonnen, who are the real bad guys who've controlled this planet for a while, right? The Atreides.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the first movie we saw was basically this: them getting to the planet, arriving on the planet, and then seeing this overnight assassination and ploy to take out the Atreides by the Harkonnen, who want the planet back.
Yes.
And by the end of the first book, I mean, by the end of the first movie, he's escaped and they think he's dead.
Mm.
But he has escaped with his mother.
Mm.
Okay, so I think that's... And so ultimately what this is it's... It starts as a coming of age, but then it becomes, as you said, so much more.
Mm.
Right. So what we're looking at politically is a neo-feudal kind of setup. Various great houses as part of a giant empire, an imperium, and there's enormous political jostling between these houses as to who has prestige, who has resources, and so on. And House Harkonnen, having been harvesting spice for decades, at least, we're not quite sure how long, have enormous power and wealth as a result. Because whoever controls the spice controls the known universe and is in command of what is essentially an resource, a super resource, so to speak. Mm. So you can see a little bit of 1960s oil politics in the background of this text. Frank Herbert clearly is quite critical of the United States imperial adventuring overseas as part of the tension around this resource, which at that point on Earth was oil, probably still is oil on Earth.
Yeah.
What is the word when you say?
So if you use the word as a prefix to a term, So an er-narrative would be a meta-narrative, a giant narrative, a narrative that subsumes all other narratives,
right.
i.e. God, if you like. That okay, that would right. be a classic er-narrative. So an er-resource is just a...
The top priority.
Absolutely.
Okay. I love this. I feel like I'm back in English Lit.
You are.
Where honestly, you just sit and just you just listen to these folks talk, and you just love. I just love hearing the language. There was that one other professor who put his fingers together, and spoke as if he was a conductor of words. Who was that person?
Well,
do you remember?
Could well have been me, but it might have been Professor Teitelstad.
It was Teitelstad, yeah. And the way he spoke, he was conducting with his fingers.
Right.
It was so lovely to hear him talk. Okay, so. Yeah, once again, come back to this, because now we've got hopefully a bit of a context. We've got this young man who's just seen his father die. He's on this crazy planet. Another important part of it is there's the native folk who live on this planet, which in the first half of the book, part one of the movie, you underestimate them. Nobody really knows them. They're called the Fremen. And of course, now we'll get into it. The second part of it all is Paul getting himself put into that world, right? But just perhaps just at the start here, just once again, like, why is this book? Why do we love this book? Why is this book special?
Before you speak, I think it's a cool opportunity to talk about how I first heard of Dune.
Okay.
And I was at the Rosebank flea market in the parking lots when I was... like 17, 18 with my girlfriend in high school at the time, who was like 16, and she was reading Leo Tolstoy, War and Peace, one of those, right?
Ooh,
like this a reader.
This was your girlfriend in high school.
She's a PhD in philosophy now from Oxford, so it's like wild. Okay. But we saw Dune on the table, and I was like, I saw the big sandworm, and I recognized the miniseries on TV from when I was a kid.
Oh, yes.
And I was like, oh, is this that series? I didn't know it was a book. And she said, this is Dune.
And that's
I was
when like, she broke up with you.
No, and she said, and then she said to me, this is like the most famous science fiction book ever written. It's like the most celebrated. It's really, really famous. And it's hard to find a copy now. So you should probably get it. I didn't have money because I was a child.
Yes.
It was before Star Wars, obviously.
Yeah.
But it was before Lord of the Rings as well?
No. Lord of the Rings is published from 1954 onwards.
Okay, so it was Dune, about 10 years before.
Yeah, Dune comes out in 1965. And as, I'm sure the figure is much greater now, but as of maybe 10 years ago or so, it had sold more than 10 million copies. Which for a science fiction text, because we've got to remember that science fiction up until pretty recently, at least initially, was a very niche genre, a very niche genre indeed. Popular post Second World War in the United States amongst boys. Boys and young men. So that's when it had its golden age, if you like. Mm. Right. Since then, it's exploded in popularity. We now have many science fiction texts coming out of China, Africa, and so on and so forth. Mm. And people of all races and genders are reading science fiction. So things have changed since that time. But yes, 1965, 10 million copies.
Wild. Okay, well, what I'd like to perhaps do, and then, guys, just as you said, Cole, you're great. Just chime in. I think there's obviously so many layers to this book and to this world, right? So I think just to wade a little further into the water, what I love so much is this idea of the Bene Gesserit. Is that how you pronounce it? Bene Gesserit? And how there's this... It's not just that our main character might be a part of something bigger. You realize that they're these witch folk. What's the best way to describe the Bene Gesserit?
Witches, for sure.
They're witches. Mm. And they have manipulated this universe.
Yeah.
They have had this plan in place, and they put these things in motion, and they manipulate people, and they can literally manipulate with their words and tell you and force you to do things. which I think is lovely. And that especially comes up in the second half, is how much Paul becomes part of this plan, because he discovers that he's a part of this prophecy where he could be this Messiah and he could have all this power. And he, of course, comes, his mother is this witch, is a Bene Gesserit. And so he's been trained and he has these things in him. And then the main point of the movie, and now I want to hand over to you guys to start talking about this, but just to sort of root it in what this book is about, is him discovering that he's a part of this bigger plan, and that he is seen as this Messiah by the people, the Fremen people, and that he can lead them to defeat the Harkonnen.
Do you think that Frank Herbert's a terrible sexist? Viewing a sort of secret cult, a secret cult of women, a secret cult of witches
all were women, hey?
Yes, indeed. Who manipulate bloodlines, who are centrally involved in the manipulation of human sexuality in order to achieve the outcome that they want to achieve. I mean, arguably, that's deeply troublesome, isn't it?
It is.
Interesting. I've never thought of that.
It is, because they, especially like viewing the book through the lens of the film, now that we're kind of going, I'm going back in my mind to what I've read, right? Is that they feel sinister as like shadow rulers, right, manipulating the system with puppet strings. Right. You know? There's this undertone or undercurrent of malevolence, yes, to it.
Lady Macbeth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So, you know, one of the things that we can do with this novel is to understand it in its time.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is kind of back to front, because I have a couple of things to tell you about Frank Herbert. Perhaps the most important is where he got his sense of the planetary ecology from, which, by the way, I thought was considerably better done in the novel than in the films.
Okay.
Although I must point out that whilst there was an early noughties Dune series, which is mostly, to my mind, quite bad, this film did a lot better than those, because it was shot partly in Abu Dhabi. I'm not sure what other deserts were utilized, but at least it was shot on location.
Yeah.
Whereas the deserts in the 2000s series are all CGI, and they look terrible.
Nice. Yeah.
They really just look, you know, it's like being in a desert computer game. It's really not compelling. So I thought this film did much better in that regard.
Yeah, you really get a good sense from the book about the bigger picture the whole time.
Right.
You get a sense of how all these planets fit together and the politics and the... and everything. But then when it comes to the planet itself, you really do feel how little water there is on this planet, and how water becomes so important.
Not one drop of rain. Not one drop of rain. So it boggles the mind. And here's what I have to tell you about Frank Herbert in this regard. So he's born in Tacoma, Washington State, which is not the city Washington on the East Coast, but West Coast, up near the Canadian border, not too far from Vancouver and Seattle. So he's born there in 1920. He becomes a journalist. I mean, he does quite a lot of different things in his life, but he becomes a journalist. And in 1959, he's sent by a publication to go and report on the dune ecologists who are working on the Oregon Dunes. And now, Oregon is just south of Washington State in the United States. And it has, rather like the Eastern Cape, a dune ecology close to the beach.
Okay.
So what they were doing is... whole lot of scientists and ecologists were measuring, and they were also conducting into experiments on how to stop the dunes from moving in the wind and via the tide. So one of the things that they were doing was organizing enough moisture, so they made wind traps, which then feature in the novel and the film. They also plant various dune-friendly low water usage plants like the creosote bush, and they actually managed to succeed in more or less, if you like, taming the dunes. What they're doing is called in science fiction terraforming. They're changing the landscape.
Yeah.
By the way, human beings have been doing this for millennia.
Because the sand can take over, right?
Right.
Deserts famously just are growing.
Yes,
exactly. So you have to do whatever you can to stop that around
right.
the world.
So we could think of the giant essentially hedge of trees that's being planted in the south of the Sahara in places like Chad, Niger, Nigeria, and so on to stop the advance of the Sahara Desert.
Mm.
We can also think of the Israelis who've done an amazing job of taming parts of the desert, making it arable and so on. And they've used oil, interestingly, back to the Ur resource.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this was clearly the foundation of Frank Herbert's novel, because this is where he got his inspiration directly for the desert planet from.
Right.
Washington State is very wet. A place like Seattle just rains all the time.
That's right.
It's just so interesting that in a place so wet, he was imagining this world that is so dry.
Right.
Where the characters have to wear special still suits.
No.
Take your sweat and sort of harness it and keep you cool. And, you know, they don't even allow you to cry. He sort of catches her tear in one moment.
Exactly.
Says, no, don't even waste a drop.
So this planet is beyond inhospitable.
Yeah.
And clearly it's been of enormous appeal to us today. Because, you know, with global warming, this could well be a possible future that we're headed towards. Yeah. So it's really compelling, this idea of a fully imagined planet that's a character. And in the novel, we get taken into that character in some detail, and we really get to see how the Fremen are part of that landscape, how that landscape is a complex web of subtle interconnections. Just to give you an idea of how sort of resonant this is, I visited Namibia for the first time a couple of years ago. And one of the things I did was a little five tour. And this is the opposite. Yeah. The big five we all know is, you know, elephants, lion, leopard, cheetah, and so on. Well, this was the little five. It was a tiny desert chameleon, a skink, a sand snake, so on. And, you think that these incredible dunes on that west coast of Africa are dead, but they're very far from it. They're actually quite full of life.
Yeah,
but it's just not life as we know it. And Herbert, I think, in the novel especially, is a genius at summoning up landscape as character or planet as character. It's very compelling, and it makes perfect sense. So he got that from the Oregon dunes south of Washington State. And you can also see another great principle of science fiction, which is the appeal of the exotic, the different, the other.
Mm.
And typically in sci-fi movies, if you think of the Star Wars franchise, for instance, we've got Tatooine, the desert planet, but we've also got jungle planets. So very often in sci-fi, you've got the very exotic landscapes, and that's happening. I mean, I think that partly derives from Dune as a good example of planet as person, planet as character.
Mm. Another thing to mention at this point, while we're sort of wading a little further into the deep water, is to then introduce the idea that this planet has worms. And so you almost want to sort of, as I said, set the human story, maybe the politics, the plot. And then, as I said, the next wave for someone to understand Dune is things like the Bene Gesserit, so that there's this manipulating plan in place. There's this idea of the prophecy. And then the other thing is these characters, one of which is the sandworm.
Mm.
So on this planet are these giant ass worms that they are super afraid of, at least in the first part. And you think of them as the enemy. to some degree, at least this was my reading of it, you think of them as this thing you've got to fear because they are so big, they are under the sand, and they could come in, they could eat a whole harvester. These huge machines that are harvesting the spice. They're a thing to be very, very afraid of. And then what I love is just where you go in the understanding of what these worms do, and we'll get into that. And,
right. So,
and how they are, and how integral they are to this world.
Yeah.
Right. I have to leap in here. I mean, where would science fiction be without a monster?
Yeah.
You know, sci-fi and fantasy both in many ways depend upon a villain. You know, you could say without the dark side, without the devil, there's no story.
Yeah.
The devil has the best tune, so to speak. So in every sci-fi or fantasy, you invariably find some sort of dragon or like a
Smaug or a... Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And the worms are that character.
Yeah.
Terrifying at first, but less terrifying when you come to see things more from a Fremen perspective. In other words, an internal perspective rather than from an outside, almost
resource colonizer
kind of perspective. Mm.
How did you guys feel when you saw the worms for the first time in the Villeneuve films?
Villeneuve.
How else do you pronounce his name, Cole?
Villeneuve?
I think it's Villeneuve, yeah.
Okay.
I think.
Like a Formula One driver?
Yes. Denis Villeneuve.
Yeah. Something like that.
Okay.
I think that, you know, one has so many expectations of how a design should be made.
Yes.
Like when you have your mind's eye, having read the book. And then I thought I was incredibly surprised. It was an unusual design when I first saw it.
Mm.
With all the teeth. Like, being the focus of the whole, right?
Yes.
Like, one is used to seeing the flaps. And I suppose that my point of reference is the flaps is the mouth from the miniseries.
Right.
That was like the design I had in my head because that's the first one I saw as a child,
yes.
Right? But I thought that it worked so well in terms of how they designed the sound of those teeth clinking together when
right.
it's looking at Paul. How you can hear it resonating is like a subharmonic frequency or something.
Mm.
All these like little things that make it feel this thing that's huge
yes.
and alive, you know? No, I loved it.
Yeah, I think it works really well. Because if you think about it, they're not really like teeth. They look big and intimidating,
yes.
but they're like filters.
They're almost like bristles.
Yeah, they're almost like a whale has,
yes.
you know?
And right in the beginning of the story, the mother... I'm sorry, what's the mother's name?
Jessica
gets assigned a person who's going to help her, a native person who's going to be like her kind of domestic helper, right?
Yeah.
And she finds on her person a kris knife.
Yes.
So we're introduced to this idea of this knife, which is made up out of those bristles.
Mm.
So you immediately start getting the sense of the fact that the Fremen, these native folk, do something, are somehow connected to these animals in such a way. But they seem as quite unknown, quite mystical, and so you still don't get a full sense of it in the first half. But in the second half, as I said, you realize how much they've harnessed and work together with these worms.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so perhaps now is the time to move on to the Fremen as a people. And
yeah.
I have something else to tell you about Frank Herbert in this regard, which is that having been born in Washington State, it's perhaps no complete surprise that he became friendly with and had many conversations with a Native American tribe that live in Washington State called the Kiliut. My pronunciation might be a little bit off, but Kiliut, I think, is how you say it. And this was a surviving tribe, and he regarded them. I think he venerated them.
Mm.
I mean, it's quite a common trope in popular culture, the veneration of indigenous peoples.
What does
and
venerate
folk.
Mean?
To venerate means to love, to
okay.
to almost to I don't want to say worship,
like idolize.
Yeah, So Hergé of Tintin fame, for instance, he was such a fan of Native American Indians that he went to the United States and eventually became so friendly with a Sioux clan that he was initiated into it. And Frank Herbert has a kind of a similar story. And he was very concerned with United States policy towards Native American so-called Indians. And he was very concerned about their land, their rights, their culture. And it's quite interesting that the Quileute people in quite close to Seattle do absolutely live on a reservation, which he visited many times and so on. So this veneration for a Native American tribe is in many ways the root origin of the Fremen as a people on this desert planet. Right. So a lot of inspiration was clearly coming from his own personal life. But we can also see once again how 1960s that was. You know, 1960s, a massive explosion of popular culture, and we see the origins in many ways of contemporary green politics in that era. But we also see the origins of the current veneration of indigenous peoples in that that era. It starts to become a big thing, essentially because you've got a big critique of Eurocentric and imperial culture going on. We shouldn't forget that the 1960s is where the liberation struggles in Africa were at their height in many places on the continent. So all of that background is feeding into this veneration of the native people. And I should also mention that It's perhaps surprising that I say this because the Fremen are depicted in the novel as being quite close to a Bedouin or an Arabic or an Islamic culture.
Yeah.
That would be the most obvious cultural aspect of them. Clearly, Herbert was drawing on the fact that that culture does come from deserts,
and
is immersed within desert landscapes. So, the Fremen go wear burqa robes. They go on razzia raids. Their warriors are called Fedekin. You know, there's so many references here to Arabic culture. A lot of their design, their wall hangings and so on. And I thought this latest part two movie did a really good job of, on the whole, of taking you into Islamic aesthetics, Islamic style, Arabic style aesthetics.
And they use the word fundamentalists a lot, which I thought was interesting. So the story really is about his... What's the best word to describe it? The way he immerses himself into the Fremen and how they take him as one of their own. So I think he is aware that he's from outside. He does have this royal bloodline in him. So he isn't a Fremen, but he's aware of that the whole time. He doesn't pretend he's not. But he gets more and more accepted by them in the story. And ultimately, like, needs to lead them, and so because he is this prophet, the prophet that they all believe in, is this outsider, right? Someone who comes from the outside,
The voice from the outer world,
The voice from the and the further south one goes in this planet, all the people who have involved the colonizers and everyone believes nothing is there, but what actually is there is more and more sort of traditional fundamentalist Fremen, which he comes to meet, and they in particular take him as this prophet.
Right. So what should we call this? Exotic indigenization.
Yeah.
That's the phrase I'm going with. Exotic indigenization. It's also important to note that that Herbert doesn't just sort of copy either Quileute Indians from, so-called Indians from the United States, or Arabic or Bedouin cultures. I mean, he does change them. So quite a lot of the culture of the Fremen seems to owe as much to Zen Buddhism as it does to the Quran.
Mm.
And in particular, he also gives us a more gender egalitarian view. So there are not very strict gender role divisions going on amongst the Fremen. We see warrior women, Amazon type women are very much part of their culture. So it would be quite different to traditional actual Bedouin culture here on planet Earth, where there are quite strict, or have been until recently, quite strict gender divisions, roles, and so on. So, you know, this is where the novelist comes in, taking license to play with his influences rather than just giving us a single copy, so to speak. He doesn't copy, he plays, he has fun.
And what comes out of that is a very strong female character, which is played by Zendaya in the movies, Chani, who takes him under her wing, so to speak, in the beginning, because he's quite useless and doesn't know how to live and survive in the desert. And then they slowly fall in love.
Yes.
So yeah, that was great. You and then what's interesting, and we were debating it after the movie, because I think we're now heading to that point where we're going to now start talking more in depth about part two. So I think start getting ready for the spoilers, but we'll give you a good warning. Is the fact that she doesn't believe in him as this prophet. She was quite denying of that, but the Javier Bardem's character, Stilgar, who's the leader of this Fremen sect that he is, you know, joining and a part of, he very much believes in him. And so it was quite interesting to see the one person looking for all the signs that this person is going to be the Messiah and the other one sort of denying it, which I thought was quite interesting. And you thought that you didn't remember her being that way in the book.
No, the book is rather different to that. Chani is not nearly as sort of feminist, rebellious, and individualist as she comes across in the film.
Yeah.
And in particular, here really is a major spoiler alert. So if you haven't seen the film yet, you might want to stop at this point.
Or read the book.
read the book, for that matter. In the film, she is extremely angry. You can see her enraged that Paul undertakes a marriage of convenience with the daughter of the emperor, the Galactic Empire, if we can call it that, in order to try and establish some sort of peace. Mm. She storms off, quite understandably so.
Yes. Mm.
And that doesn't happen in the novel at all. In fact, the novel ends with Jessica speaking to and about Chani, about how it will be said in future that though they weren't the official wives, Paul never shared a moment of tenderness with his official wife.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, all his attention was on his quite legitimate in this world concubine, i.e. Chani. And in fact, he never has intercourse with the daughter of the emperor with his official wife. His loyalty is entirely to Chani. So It's a very different ending in the novel to what we saw in
that
the film,
and
I think Villeneuve is showing, you know, that's where he shows his colors as a kind of contemporary feminist, so to speak, which is not what goes on in the books. In Dune Messiah, Chani dies towards the end in childbirth, giving birth to twins who are Paul's children.
That's a super spoiler alert because what
you can edit that out if you like.
No, well, what Villeneuve has now revealed in the wake of part two coming out is that he would like to make this a trilogy. So Frank Herbert wrote the original Dune, and then because, as we've said this whole time, the universe is so expansive, there were other books.
Yeah.
There were many. And even his son wrote more afterwards, right? There's a good 10 odd books, right?
Something like that.
And one of the, which is Dune Messiah, which is this natural third act of the story. And so we are going to get that, hopefully.
Yeah.
We believe
if this sells enough money.
Yeah, we believe we'll get it. So yeah, they had to sort of adapt things a little to sort of head in that direction.
Yeah.
But perhaps at this point, yeah, if that wasn't enough of a spoiler, just to make it more clear that now let's get into this on a more plot basis so that, especially those who've read the book or have seen part two now, you can get into it.
Yeah.
And I thought perhaps a good place to start is the fact that in part two now you meet the Emperor, who is the main mighty sort of figure over this whole known universe. And this is the Emperor who put the Atreides in charge of Arrakis.
Yes.
And you kind of wonder why, and you kind of wonder, because they set them up to fail in a sense, and you sort of wonder what this bigger plan is. And in the first half, at least for me, it felt like he was this distant person that you had no idea of who he was and what's going on. But in the second half, you get to meet him, and he's got this daughter, right? Princess Irulan. How do you pronounce it?
Irulan.
Yeah. And as we've said, you know, the whole story is about Paul, and he realizes that the one way in which he can rise to the greatest power is to actually take the place of this emperor. And so the way to do that, there's no other kind of way. And this is, you know, when he comes into his own and when he sort of starts harnessing this power and this ability to see into the future, which is a big part of his kind of coming of age, I guess, throughout the whole story, is that he sees all the different paths he can take. And this is the one path that makes the most sense, which is to take the hand of the door of the princess so that he can then become the emperor.
Right.
What's interesting, at least for me, is that the princess has been leaving these sort of diary entries, and the book starts from the beginning with these diary entries.
Yeah.
And you don't know who this princess is when you start. You don't know you're just dropped in this world.
Mm.
So anyone who were to be starting the book without any context, it's difficult, right? Because you get given this princess from the beginning talking about this prophecy and talking, but you've got no idea how this is all going to take shape.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting move in the book that this whole thing was obviously realized. But then the movie obviously doesn't give you that, because that would be way too confusing if the first part started with the princess talking about this prophecy and talking about, you know, this figure.
Right.
So I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, so really the movie builds up towards that. It doesn't start with that, which as you say, is a gentler approach for the viewer or the reader. So I think the key thing here is that Frank Herbert is no lover of big governments.
Yes.
He's a proper American in that he's a fierce individualist. He believes strongly in individual rights, and he wants the state to be controlled. So he's very critical of the United States itself. Let's not forget that the U.S. is, as the United States, an empire.
Mm.
It's something we easily forget about the United States. We also easily forget one of Herbert's other pet hates, which was Russia. Russia is also an empire. It's a kind of giant umbrella under which all these many ethnicities attempt to reside. So he was a disliker of big governments, and he's in particular disliking big government because he sees it as Byzantine. Byzantine being a reference to the Byzantine Empire. Empire under Constantinople, which became not only a noun but also an adjective. So the word Byzantine, if you use the word Byzantine to describe a government, it's incredibly giant, sprawling, bureaucratic. Left hand doesn't know what right hand is doing. You've got inefficiencies of scale and opportunities for immense corruption with a giant Byzantine government. So this is what Frank Herbert was against. He disliked that strongly. And we can see him criticizing his own nation in that.
And that's very much what's happening in this universe.
Very much. Very much so. Yeah. And so the other bit of information that I have for you about Frank Herbert is that Frank Herbert not only went to the Oregon Dunes and became fascinated by the work of the ecologists there, he also was fascinated by indigenous so-called native tribes. But a third thing is that he read T.E. Lawrence's The Seven Pillars of Wisdom.
Okay.
Now,
what's that?
This was a kind of an autobiography that was published in 1926. T.E. Lawrence was a British Army officer who went to what is modern-day Jordan in the early part of the 1900s. And he basically, the phrase is, went native and became rather like Paul in June, became a member of or an honorary member of the local Bedouin tribes. And he led them in an uprising against the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire at that time, which ruled huge swathes of what's basically the modern Arab world. So Iraq, Iran, Syria, Jordan, and so on, Lebanon and so on, were controlled in quite a draconian fashion by the Ottoman Empire. And T.E. Lawrence, you know, partly working from a British point of view, British interests, the interests of the British Empire, but also wanting to support the local, as he saw it, oppressed Bedouin people, led an uprising.
Okay.
So this is where Paul comes from. Paul is the voice from the outer world. He's the stranger who comes, goes native, is accepted into the local tribe, and then leads them in a rebellion against an imperial force that's clearly exploiting them. That's clearly abusing the ecology of their planet. That's clearly resource extracting colonialism. Right. So this is where the politics of the books really happen. Mm. And the issue that comes up is the question of whether a foreigner who becomes accepted and localized remains nevertheless a dubious, condescending kind of leader. Because, you know, at one level we could say that in terms of race politics, we've got a white man coming to save brown people from other white people.
I was about to say, like, what are your thoughts? A frequent criticism of Dune novel and film is that it's a white savior narrative.
Right. And there's no question that there is that. However, I think that's to understand the novel in quite a superficial and shallow sort of a way, and the movie too, because one of the things I really like about this text is how well thought out it is. And Frank Herbert is at pains to show several things. I mean, there's quite a long list of them, so I'll just try and be as brief as possible. But number one, clearly he as an author has got huge respect. I used this word veneration. You could almost say awe or reverence,
right,
or even worship for the Fremen. He absolutely admires them, and he admires the fact that they are so integrated with landscape. But the trendy academic word for this, it's a very pretentious term, is transcorporeal.
Sounds good.
He sees the Fremen as being transcorporeal. Their bodies belong to the planet, are interpenetrated by the planet. And the fact that the water, when you die as a Fremen, they take they extract the water from your body, which they use to create these giant underground wells, which they hope to use in future to make the desert bloom, to make Arrakis a more fertile planet. This is a good example of that Fremen transcorporeality. So number one, the Fremen are objects of reverence. Also, they're fiercely individualist, even though they've got a very strong communal identity. Each one of them is very clearly an individual character. They are immensely loyal to each other. There's, again, the strong sense of community, despite or because of that individualism on their part. They are extremely careful. There are people that have to take minute care over every little thing. So it's not possible for them to really get up in the morning and walk outside. They have to put on one of their stillsuits. And just a little aside here on stillsuits, the scientists tell us that stillsuits are not actually really practical because the human body needs to shed about 90 watts of heat per day. And that wouldn't be possible inside something like a stillsuit. You'd basically boil to death in there. So you know, that could be a problem with the science of the text. But leaving that aside, they're people who, as you pointed out, they can't even shed a tear. Every single drop of water is paid careful attention to, and clearly Herbert respects that in a massive way. And he's suggesting that we need to become a lot more like that if we're going to survive on our planet. Yeah. So there's that. Further, Paul has massive respect for the Fremen. He regards himself as a kind of a water wasteful indulgent interloper, at least initially. He sees himself, I think you pointed this out, as a bit of a weakling, you know. And he has to go through a series of quite brutal initiations to be accepted by this desert clan. So he has to there are several things. The first is that he gets into a knife fight with Jameis, with one of them. He doesn't want it. He doesn't choose it. He's pretty much forced into it, but he does kill one of the Fremen in this knife fight. So he has to accept their notions of honor and warrior culture, so to speak.
And even in the book, he has to then take the guy's wife.
Yes, he does.
A little bit, but they conveniently left that out of the movies because that's one more character we didn't need to invest ourselves in.
Well, I personally thought that that's an egregious omission. They went a bit. I would have liked it if she'd been there because she is quite a character and she does challenge Paul.
Yeah.
And by the way, this is not an unusual thing. Many tribal ancient cultures have
you got to take the wife of the guy you killed.
Yes, interesting. Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's got to be looked after, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it's a thing in Zulu culture here in South Africa, for instance.
Oh, really?
You know, if the husband dies, then the husband's brother or relative is responsible for looking after the wife. I mean, at one level, it's dubiously condescending, perhaps.
Sure.
But at another level, it's a survival.
It's practical.
Very practical.
Yeah.
And a survival thing. So it's that's not uncommon. Secondly, he has to, he has to find a way to coexist. He has to learn all the cultural tropes, the belief systems, the language, the greetings, and so on. He has to endure spice. There's a lot of spice in pretty much everything they eat, and it has psychoactive, components. So an important aspect of the Messiah character here is what's called, this is really a super pretentious polysyllable.
Nice.
This is a purple polysyllable, ethnopsychopharmacology.
Okay.
He has to endure essentially a psychedelic trip of two kinds. The first kind is just ingesting spice all around him, which does change your mindset and so on.
And these Fremen very lovely depiction, the Fremen have these blue eyes.
Yes.
Which he then obviously gets throughout the story.
Right.
As he ingests more of this.
Right. So the whites of your eyes disappear the more spice you have, in your diet or ingest otherwise. So he has to endure that. And then further, he's got another initiation to go through, which is much tougher. This is proper ethno-psychopharmacology. This is Terence McKenna's Food of the Gods kind of thing, where he has to ingest the water of life. This is a liquid and a very powerful hallucinogenic drug that he must take. And it takes him into a full-on near-death.
Yeah.
Near-death experience. And we don't see this so much in the film, but in the novel, he's in a coma with hardly any vital signs at all it's a period of some months, if I remember correctly. It's certainly weeks.
Yeah, it is a long time, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's 6 weeks or something like that. I'd have to check that up and to be precise about it. But he's in a coma, so he has to endure sort of a really serious near-death experience, which he might not have survived. Mm. Which he was very lucky to survive. That's part of the Bene Gesserit kind of prophecy, because previously all men who've ingested the water of life have died.
Mm.
Yeah. It's only ever women who've survived this enormous near-death experience. So this is a, when I say a brutal initiation, I was being quite literal about it. Mm, and then finally, he has to learn to ride a worm, which is the
So this is the whole next level. Is that as I said, there are these worms which you think are just, you know, incredibly huge. As I said, they can swallow machinery. And then in the second half of the story, you come to realize that the Fremen ride them.
Right.
they are able to jump on them, or they call them in a particular way. Then they can jump on them, and with harpoons, they use them as like transportation.
Right, right.
Which is wild.
It's a very Avatar moment, you know.
Yeah.
In Avatar, the natives ride these sort of dragon creatures. So it's very similar to that. And it's very important that they ride the worms against the Harkonnen and against the Emperor at the end of the novel, at the end of the film. It's a major aspect of their defeat of the evil empire is to use the local resource of which they are masters to defeat the empire.
It's desert power, right?
Desert power.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was lovely to obviously see and imagine in my head, because this was the first book, I think, perhaps my whole life, where I'd read the book before I'd seen the movie.
Right.
At least for part two. I'm not entirely sure how I could have done the book without seeing part one, but that's me personally. Mm. So I'd love to know how. Well, I wish I could see the imagination in your guys' head, but it was very exciting to see that. And the other thing which I thought was really lovely was to come to realize that the worms are integral in the making of the spice.
Yes.
And that they get called makers by sort of the second half of the story. And that they are integral. They're not this evil thing that stops the spice. They make it.
Yeah, it's like to your point about the planet being a character, right? The desert being a character, is that it's not just this empty landscape,
right?
It's not just a vista. It's this thing that's got this very well-defined integrated ecosystem, right? Where the worms also are not just monsters. They're integral to the creation of the spice, the water of life, these things that Paul uses on his messianic journey.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So yes, I mean, I do think that quite understandable critique of Dune as being, featuring a dubious white messiah who leads a native people as though they're not capable of leading themselves, which they certainly are and have been doing ongoingly, very effectively, by the way. Mm.
Yes.
Giving the Harkonnens a total thorn in their side for decades. But So it's really the veneration of the Fremen that undermines that whole critique of the novel. But there's also something else which we haven't really touched on yet, which is really crucial to the politics of this world that Frank Herbert created. And that is that whilst we could understand Paul going native, so to speak, joining the Fremen and then helping them to lead a revolt against the resource-grabbing empire, and the Harkonnen sort of, what to call them, really, they're just agents of empire, I suppose. Anyway, the reason why that view is really missing the key political point that Dune is making as a novel is that what's being described is classic nationalist anti-colonial resistance. That's the key political thing. I mean, you know, the uprising of the local people against the resource-extracting yoke of a foreign empire is what's going on in the novel. Except that Herbert complicates it, and he complicates it in a delicious way that speaks to all of our experience of so-called revolution on planet Earth, which is that most of the revolutions on planet Earth have caused so much suffering that they've arguably become worse than what they've replaced. It's a most unfortunate fact. You know, I mean, the French Revolution is one instance. Napoleon crowns himself emperor by 1805, and then there's the Napoleonic Wars causing the death of millions. 54 million Russians die by the time of Stalin in Russia. 64 million Chinese people after Chairman Mao's Cultural Revolution in China. So Frank Herbert picks up on all that, and he makes Paul absolutely paranoid, understandably so, that by embarking on this resistance struggle, he's setting in motion a cycle of violence that he cannot control and that will spin out of his control and spin into the entire known universe and cause the death of billions. So in the novel, we have all of these dreams that Paul has with his sense of terror about who he's becoming and what will happen.
So you say that's the big difference, is that he's at least aware of it and critiquing the fact that that's what happens in these revolutions.
Right. So Frank Herbert gives us a very subtle politics that's not just a rah-rah hero, white boy who takes a drug, saves the universe.
And they lived happily ever after.
It's actually the opposite of that. And it has to be said that this is quite unpleasant at some level. I'm perfectly aware that as I'm speaking, I'm saying sort of horrible things, really, that spoil all our sort of desire to revel in this messianic prophecy. Actually, the prophecy is a nightmare.
And
that's what's really uncomfortable about this text. And that's at heart what gives a lie to this criticism that it's just, you know, a romantic narrative.
Comes in, about sorts it out, gets out.
Even in like the language that Frank Herbert uses in one of the appendices, which is talking about Kynes, who is the character who he's the like Imperium planetologist who's put in charge of the planet. And he's the one who creates this whole plan to turn Dune into like a, you know, save it, essentially.
He's terraform it.
Yeah. And in somewhere in there, the sentence that he uses, the language that he uses is something along the lines of, the last thing Kynes expected was for Dune to be afflicted with a hero.
Right.
Like afflicted with a hero. It's like negative language associated with a heroic figure. It's saying like this hero is a bad thing, essentially, to put it simply.
Film, it was the black woman, hey?
Yes. Mm. Paul is absolutely an anti-hero. Yeah. Like, people forget this. And I think the genius of talking about, you know, the prophecy and his vision of it and accepting it, the genius of the book for me is that it integrates that well into a character problem, right, is he doesn't just, it's not just because he wants to help the natives. You know, it's not like Lawrence of Arabia, Last of the Mohicans, like kind of thing going on, Last Samurai.
Dances with Wolves, that sort of thing.
Dances with Wolves. Yeah. It's also because he has to do it if he wants to get revenge for his father.
Yes.
Right? If he wants to avenge his family and take revenge on the emperor for designing the scheme, and the Bene Gesserit for that matter, for enacting it, he has to become the Messiah.
Yeah.
He like doesn't have a choice. It's such a brilliant crisis.
Right.
Yeah, that's a great point.
So it's, you know, it's at one level quite a profound questioning of all the messianic narratives that we've had through history around savior figures. You can see Frank Herbert critiquing or at least questioning conventional Christianity, for instance, which was in his heritage. So these are very uncomfortable sorts of questions he's asking, and it you know, makes the audience uncomfortable at some level too, to have clearly, or what seems to be clearly, a hero character who slowly, inexorably, ineluctably morphs into an anti-hero. And you can see this happening.
Inexorably, what does that mean?
Inexorably, unstoppably. You know, he can't.
I used to pronounce it inexorably.
You can pronounce it that way too.
Oh, can we? Okay.
Yes, you can.
Cool.
I love how you even had it in your vocabulary. It's very new to me.
You could tell he had an Oxford girlfriend, right? Yeah.
He got all he could out of that relationship.
Right.
Inexorable. What?
So if something is inexorable, it means it's unstoppable, it's implacable, it's going to happen no matter what you do. And this is classic politics, really, because he's sort of saying that many of the dictator figures in history start out with good intentions.
Yeah, Mugabe.
Right. Stalin, Putin, Hitler, and so on. Yeah. Start out with arguably good intentions to advance their own people and so on and so forth. But get caught in this Byzantine web of intrigues and payoffs and maneuvering. And this, once again, is Herbert's big political point, is that we can see these characters almost becoming victims of what they themselves have created. There's that wonderful jazz classic, "Success has made a failure of our home." So you could see somebody like Mugabe, for instance, as ending up being a victim of the webs of intrigue that got him into power, that have kept him in power.
Mm.
Perhaps that's being a little bit too generous to the dictators of history, but that's part of the point that Herbert is making, and I think it's a very powerful point.
Lovely. I think getting your insight on Herbert has been lovely for me, because it's just such a thing that obviously you can't get from the book, only research around the book, which someone like yourself has done for this course. Have you taught it already this year? Oh, no, the year's just starting. You're going to do it again this year?
Unfortunately, not this year, but I will certainly be doing it in future.
Because, I mean, now more than ever, people would be interested in that.
Well, you know, I'd be very happy to talk to any audience about this text. As you can tell, I sort of like it.
Yeah, and you were at the screening with a Dune-inspired T-shirt, which we all appreciated.
Envious.
And the four of us were able to really appreciate it. And I think why I would love why I wanted to set up an episode like this and just even try our best to scratch the surfaces of this desert planet is because I think the majority of that audience in that IMAX on Wednesday didn't have a clue what was going on.
Yeah.
I think there were a handful, obviously, that were excited, that had read the book, that had at least seen part one, but I think there were a couple that came as part of a free invite that I think were like, what on earth are we watching?
Oh, there was a part one?
Oh, what do you mean part two? And so I think the more people can get the context, the better. I think the more that they can be inspired by everything that came together to create the book, the more you can appreciate it.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I mentioned to you that I'd read a BBC review just a few days back, and I was a bit shocked at what a hack job it was because...
Yeah, no, they clearly gave it to the wrong person.
Yeah, I mean...
They let that one slip past the gate.
Yeah, all they could say about the movie was that, or part two of the movie is that it was weird and not conventional Hollywood.
Yeah.
So wow. Both of those things are certainly true, but there's a bit more to it than that. So
at the very least, you have to watch part one, because it's not going to be the standalone story for anyone who was thinking it might have been. And then, of course, the book is just giving you so much more. And then, of course, you've got another 9 books to enjoy thereafter if you really want. But perhaps just on the very last note, because I do know that you've got to now get to class soon.
Yes.
Is that, the film itself was great. And I think that's perhaps just one of the last things, to just say what we appreciate about part two and perhaps the films together, is that I think they do a great job.
Yeah, I mean, for me, this text has been successful because, as we've touched on now, it's so thoroughly imagined. It's so carefully worked out. It's got so many aspects to it, and it brings them all together. And it's perfectly possible to enjoy the movie as a spectacle, but you can also dive deep into it and gain a great deal of information and knowledge from it. And I think that's the reason why it's endured. It's rather like Lord of the Rings. It's just a really thoroughly imagined, carefully imagined
world.
There's
languages that have been created. And
for sure. Yeah. So because of that depth of imagining, which you can take at whichever level you like, it's spoken to generations of readers, and I see no reason why that's going to stop anytime soon.
Yeah.
So I'd just like to say in conclusion, thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Treat. It's sort of almost a year in the making. It was us talking about doing this kind of chat, and it's taken me back in many ways, back to my English classes that I loved and appreciated so much. I felt that those 2 years gave me the opportunity to just understand literature so much better, where I could at least talk it through myself and with others as to sort of where books and literature sort of fits in.
Yeah.
I appreciate you.
Thank you once again.
Yeah, lovely. Guys, any last thoughts while we're here?
That's a fucking great movie.
Yeah.
it's that. The deep bass rumble. For almost 3 hours, it was an assault in many good ways, and the plan is to screen it at the Bioscope. I have at this time had the Joburg Film Festival take up would be the first week of this film, and I really think that any real diehard Dune fan is going to watch it in the way in which we watched it, which is in IMAX, which is the way that it's intended to be watched.
Yes,
absolutely.
But there is only so much real estate for IMAX, and so we, as the Bioscope, will take it in the weeks later, where you can still appreciate it. Just the sound is something that...
I'm keen to see it again.
Yeah, and I think there is so much more, so yeah.
Please
so
do a double bowl.
I was about to say, you have to do a double
bowl. We have to, because especially that's how it needs to be seen. I really enjoyed rewatching part one. There's just so much to take in and so much to look for, and especially see how much of the second half of the story is given to you in part
one
without you even being aware of it.
Yes.
Yeah. And look out for all those things. But yeah, thank you for your time, Gerald. We really appreciate you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Keep up the good work of helping people discover lovely words and obviously just appreciating this kind of work. So
yes.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right. Cheers. All right. What a great chat. I feel like I'm back at... at Senate House.
Right.
At Wits. And I've just had my mind blown. No, I appreciate it. And I appreciate someone who's put in that extra research.
Because
I don't think we would have necessarily done it. Maybe we would have gone down some YouTube rabbit holes or looked a bit further if we had the time. But
yeah.
I really appreciated someone giving that context of Frank Herbert.
Yes.
I think that really helped.
Yeah, it's definitely necessary. And it's a good reminder that when you read a text or even watch a movie, there's so much more thinking for you to do about it.
Yeah.
And, you know?
And it didn't come from nowhere. I think that's also quite inspiring for anyone listening to this who's an aspiring writer.
Yeah.
Is that you never know where that inspiration is going to come from. I mean, you can imagine that Georgia sand dune trip is like arguably maybe like a boring piece of journalist work.
Yes.
But it set forth the most important thing in your life, which is the fact that you birthed this book.
Yeah.
You know, Herbert isn't known for anything else.
Yes.
You know, it's Dune.
Yeah.
And it came from that little writing assignment, which I think is so interesting.
Yeah.
And of course, the context, you know, we find ourselves in such an interesting place in the world right now.
Mm.
And it'll be interesting to see what this creates.
Yeah.
You know, an interesting example is the movie Civil War coming out. We saw the trailer for it.
Yes.
Before we watched Dune. This is Alex Garland.
Yes.
Making a movie about what it would be like if America broke out into actual civil war now.
Yeah.
Which I'm excited to screen at the Bioscope. I'm excited to watch.
Mm. Yeah,
the Americans are attacking each other.
Yeah.
Like they can't conceive that, but it's very possible.
Yeah.
No, absolutely, dude.
It's lovely. Okay, but I think what a lovely day. I don't think let's chat much more. Let's be alone with our thoughts as we lock up here and go home. Next week will be a little bit lighter.
Yeah.
It's going to be with Jack Parra.
Nice.
He's going to pop in to rent something.
Very cool.
All right. Homebase is thevideostore.co.za. Let us know what you think of Dune. Let us know how it was different to what you imagined if you've read the book.
Hmm.
And also, yeah, just your thoughts and feelings about the chat. And thank you. We appreciate you. If you're still listening at this point, you're
give you a hug.
You're a darling. All right. Thanks, and we'll see you again next week.
Yeah.
All right. Cheers, guys.
Bye bye.
Cheers.